use, we'll just
go hunting for it.
I'm good.
Madison rejoins. Did y'all change the number out there?
I will.
Losers for getting here late.
We're on top of
you. Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud or I thought I was just thinking it?
You're just thinking.
Listen, we're not all retired.
I bet I got it before you did this morning.
You probably did.
But we had a better lunch than he did.
That is 100%.
There's no doubt.
What was it?
What's
La Placita.
La Placita.
830 Old Morgantown Road, if you want good.
The best Mexican food.
Really? Is there anybody else, man?
That's the only place left in
I will just tell you, it's semi-sketch, but it's really good.
That's how you know it's a good Mexican restaurant.
Really good.
Yeah. If it don't look like... I'm getting a lot of amens from you. This is good.
Okay, well, I want to go.
All right, we got Ian. Was Matt in the hallway or anything? Matt Brown? Okay.
Change the number on the door.
I changed it for Ian.
Okay.
All right. So, we are looking at our human need for identity tonight, and we're depending on the approach that you guys want to take. Does anybody have any other further thoughts on, you guys want to talk about the cultural things? Or do you want to talk about, like, higher level apologetics?
I think we'll probably have a better idea as we get closer.
As we get closer still? No,
Probably, I would say, a couple more weeks, and then we'll see where we want to go.
Let me poll again. How many of you want option one? Okay, how many of you want option two? Okay, so the option two has got a slight lead, but we'll... And maybe, so next quarter, on Sunday mornings, I'm supposed to be teaching Song of Solomon to you guys, which I think is going to be an important study. But I don't need 13 classes for Song of Solomon. So we could make it kind of a weird quarter where half of it we do the rest of option one, and then, which might lead well, actually, into Song of Solomon because of the nature of some of these issues. And then go into Song of Solomon. So that could be one way to kind of get both of them. Do you guys kind of like that idea as an option? Okay. All right. Well, we'll figure it out. Okay. So let's remind ourselves of a couple things. The purpose of these classes, the main goal of them really is to show how Christianity makes better sense of the world. When you put on the lens or the worldview of Christianity, if it fits with our human experiences and it fits with what we need, the deepest needs that we're talking about, then it might be an indicator that the worldview is true. And so we want to show that it makes better sense of the world than a secular materialistic worldview or any other worldview. Strengthen our own faith, and then thirdly, provide a tool and hopefully some confidence for conversations that you guys might have. We've been talking about this every time. I think it's important to bring this up every time. If you were going to diagnose skepticism as if it were a disease or something, what are some causes of it?
Emotional.
What was that?
Sorry. It's mainly emotional, but bad religious experience, dissatisfaction or disillusionment with current situations, raised as that way.
Yep. Good. Any other ones do you guys remember?
Justification for sin.
Yeah, justification for sin. So I think we got all of them then. So you got desire to sin. And what can oftentimes be the leading thing are the really intellectual sounding arguments, but what's behind it is something deeper than what seems like the deep academic discussion. It's really like, I want to have justification for this sin or whatever it might be. Okay, second one, bad religious experience. So you got a bad taste of something. Or thirdly, cultural background beliefs. You live in the, and I had that quote from Sleepy Hollow last week about it, how everybody in Sleepy Hollow, the city, they all just kind of believed in apparitions and things like that. So there's the question at the end of Sleepy Hollow: was the headless horseman Bron Bones, or was it actually a headless horseman? I don't know. So those are the causes of skepticism. Do you guys have anything you'd add to that? I think that pretty well covers a lot of them. There's probably another way to like subdivide some of this kind of stuff. But okay, so for tonight, we're talking about our need for identity. So let's start out with this question. What is identity?
How you view yourself.
Yeah, good. So your self-understanding, like what is it that you think about yourself? There's another, I like that way of thinking about it, and there's another way to think about it as well. So you can think about it like your identity is whatever is identical about you in every hat that you wear. So like I'm a preacher, I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a brother. Like your identity is the thing that's at its core true about you no matter what hat you're wearing. Because when you put on a different hat, like you're gonna act a little different. Like I don't talk to Samantha when her and I are just having a conversation like I would teach a Bible class, you know. So but that doesn't mean that somebody's hypocritical. It just means that you're adjusting to the environment that you're in at the moment or whatever. But so your identity is what is at core true about you no matter what hat you're wearing. Does that make sense? Which goes back to this idea of self-understanding. Okay, so like we've talked about in other classes, what we're going to do is we're going to contrast the secular approaches to figuring out self-understanding and then contrast that with the biblical worldview, and then, again, we're left with the question, which one matches our sensibilities better? So, anybody have any comment? Are you okay, man?
Yeah.
What happened?
Playing basketball Sunday
afternoon. Wow.
Did you change the number on the door?
I got it.
A little brevity to the injury there.
Wow, man. All right. So, we're going to compare the worldviews and then see which one seems to match our sensibilities better. Do you guys have any comments or questions about any of that before we get into specifically identity and how the secular worldview would try to build it? All right. So, instead of just talking about one approach that a secular person might have to identity, we're going to contrast the traditional approach with the modern approach, not to defend either one of them, but to help us understand what kind of culture we live in today. So, Carl Truman, he is a Bible professor at some college, I forget which one, but he wrote a book recently called The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. And so in the book he describes how traditional cultures would develop their self-understanding and then how we in our culture today do. So this is the traditional approach. Culture, at least historically, directs the individual outward. It is in communal activities that individuals find their true selves. The true self in traditional culture is therefore something that is given and learned, not something that the individual creates for himself. So the characterization that I have of it right here is that the traditional approach to understanding yourself works from the outside in. Meaning that, let's say that you lived in the 1200s and Dad was a silversmith. What are you supposed to be? Right, but what if you want to be an artist? Sorry, like it's just what's expected of you, you know. And so you work from what the expectations are in your family or in society, and then you got to learn to stuff whatever desires you have and just submit and acquiesce to those expectations that everybody else has around you. So that's the traditional approach. And I think there's probably subcultures in the United States that still carry some of that kind of thing. But let's contrast this with what I think is the more widespread approach in the United States now, or at least in the Western world. The modern approach, Carl Truman says, psychological categories and an inward focus are the hallmarks of being a modern person. This is expressive individualism that each one of us finds our meaning by giving expression to our own feelings and desires. So you see how I characterize that here. This is inside out. So what he's saying here is to be a modern person means that you give expression to, well, this is who I am, and you guys better all accept it. In fact, you guys better have parades over it, and you guys better like lavish me with praise because this is who I am. So the traditional approach says stuff your feelings and accept what everybody else expects of you. And this gets flipped in the modern approach. Do you feel like that's a pretty good description of today, how people try to figure out their sense of identity? I think that's a good way of describing that. Do you guys have any comments or questions up to that point? You got something important?
Where would you think, like, we would fit into that? Because it's, I don't know, we kind of give and take from both of them.
We do, and we're going to talk about, the biblical worldview takes the best part of both of these things and drops off the worst part of both of them. So we'll head that direction. So anything else you guys want to say just before we keep going here? Okay, so Glenn Close, she is an actress that she played in some movie. I forgot what movie it was, but she gave like a speech for when she accepted her whatever grant. Is it a Grammy or an Emmy?
Oscar.
Do people even watch those things anymore? And anybody who does just like looked away from me. Okay, so Glenn Close, she said this after she won some award, whatever it was. I feel what I've learned through this whole experience is that women, we're nurturers. That's what's expected of us. We have our children, our husbands, but we have to find personal fulfillment. We have to follow our dreams. We have to say, I can do that, and I should be allowed to do that. All right, so I think this is a cultural example of somebody following this modern approach. What reactions or reflections do you guys have to what she's saying here?
I feel like you see this a lot when you look at men and women's roles
in
society right now. It's like men do not dare be masculine, and women, you better be a boss babe or poo-poo on you.
Right. And here, it's like, do you notice how she says here? We have our children, our husbands, but, that's a contrast, we have to find personal fulfillment. As if you couldn't find that in children or a husband. Like as if there's this, but so she's saying, like, we got to break free, and I'm not, there's maybe a lot of things to say counterpoint to some of this. But this is just one example of somebody saying, like, hey, like, I need to break free of what people expect of me, and I need to be able to do things however I want to do them, or whatever. Okay, so that's the traditional and the modern approach, and you guys probably already see this on the notes. But both of these approaches, I don't know if you guys have ever really like deeply thought about the song Let It Go. Have you guys ever looked at the death metal version of the song? It's hilarious. Like, it's just really good. It's probably better than the original. But in the song, so Elsa, she, like, the song starts out with her kind of bemoaning her circumstances. So she says, don't let them in, don't let them see, be the good girl you always have to be, conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. So
you don't have to sing it.
Okay, all right. So do you see how at the beginning of the song, she's operating under the traditional identity? Like, what is it in the movie that she's got the ability to do that she doesn't want anybody else to know?
The ice powers.
Like, conceal, don't feel, don't let them know. Everybody has to expect, there's expectations, and if they found out that I could do these things, don't let them know. And then the song, like, becomes, like, really, like the dress changes and all this kind of stuff. And then it goes to the modern identity, where she says, well, now they know, let it go, can't hold it back anymore, let it go, turn away and slam the door, I don't care what they're going to say. You see how... So just cancel Disney Plus. It's just Disney starts with a D.
I like it better when you sing it.
Because it's of the devil.
Amen.
So what does it mean in the song to let it go?
Let the feelings go. Accept me who I am.
Yeah, like, let it go. I'm not going to hold it back anymore. This is who I am. And you see this in certain subcultures of the United States where people have said, like, forget what anybody else thinks. We're going to be prideful about this lifestyle or whatever. And I don't care what anybody's going to say. I'm just going to go ahead and be who I am. So that I would say that we live more in this modern kind of thing. You guys, if you were a secular humanist kind of person, would there be any disagreements you'd have about this characterization? Because we're about to criticize it, but I want to accurately portray it first.
Say that again.
Do you think this is an accurate portrayal that even like an atheist would agree with of how people build identity today?
Modern approach?
Yeah. Yeah, Matt.
One thing that I find kind of interesting is But yeah, we call it the modern approach. But if you look throughout history, you can see a strict divide, especially a debate in between hedonism and the idea of stoicism.
Right.
Which is the idea of stoicism being personal responsibility and whole truth of characteristics. And hedonism, at its very base, is do what makes you happy.
Right.
And so, yeah, modern and traditional approach. But that was a debate that Socrates was having in the halls of Athens, was hedonism versus, you know, personal responsibility.
Yep.
And so I can see where it would be now more accepted today. But
it especially, it's more widespread in the Western world than maybe it was in the 1940s or something. Right. Yeah, yeah.
But
this is not a new debate.
No.
Right, that's a good point. Yep. All right, anything else you guys want to say about that?
I feel like it's kind of... I play devil's advocate a lot, and I feel like it's kind of an extremist point of view because you don't really see a lot of people acting like that and showing that off unless you're really looking for it or like loud minorities. If you talk to like Joe at, I don't know, your work, is he gonna divulge all this stuff about how he feels and who he really is and things like that? Or is he just gonna, you know, be who he is? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, so in other words, like, how passionate are people about this?
There's a varying degree of passion.
And, yeah, so I think what this goes back to what Charles Taylor, the Canadian philosopher, talked about with background beliefs. This is kind of the air that we breathe in our society. So, like, is Joe's going to be who he wants to be? That's exactly the modern approach. Like, he's not going to submit to what anybody says that he needs to be doing or whatever. Like, that is how we are. Like, how zealous and how outspoken he's going to be about it might be determined by how much pushback he feels in society. If he feels like if there's more pushback, then he's going to fight harder, which is why I think the LGBT community and everything is pretty vocal, for example. But the air that we breathe in our society is you be true to yourself, I would say.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But the secular approaches you're talking about here too, some degree, I think, are also associated with generationalism. Because where you are in life, with regard to how you are and how you look at traditional versus modern, or finding a blend of those two, and it's still being secular.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, because early on, if you're a line walker and you're a secular person, you're going to be more impacted by outside in.
Yeah.
As you live your life and you become more comfortable in your own skin, then the inside out might begin to have more impact on you.
Sure.
Where what you're going to get into a little bit later from a Christian standpoint, like McCourt was asking about, where we're a blend of a number of those things influenced by God's Word,
right,
the life of Christ, you know, our view of eternity, and
right,
our faith.
Yep.
So, but I really think from a generation standpoint, I think even today, somebody that's my age compared to a 20-year-old, compared to a 33-year-old.
32.
Yeah, excuse me. 32-year-old. There's a lot of different perspectives going on
right there
with regard to where somebody gets comfortable with how they see themselves and their willingness to express that to the outside world.
Right. I was just trying to be true to myself. 32. I'm not going to accept your expectations of me being 33.
Right.
But
it's kind of weird because it seems like kind of an ebb and flow in society.
Yes.
Like expectations and like self-fulfillment. And so it's like, I think a lot of times I see in my experience, my limited experience, that, you know, people want you, like as a college student, to go and live your life, like be you, follow your dreams. But then at the same time, they're telling you, like, get a job. Like,
I know, yes.
Yeah, and like they have these responsibilities and expectations that you have to uphold to. And so I think the world is even confused about what approach they want to take with this.
That's a good, yes.
Yeah.
Well, and final, a good example of that is what they call during COVID, the Great Resignation, where so many people just quit their jobs. And it's like, what am I going to do? I don't really know, and I don't really care, but I got something better. There's got to be something better than this.
Yeah.
Or I'm not going to keep living this life, my life this way.
Right.
You know, and again, it goes with some of these same kinds of thoughts that we're talking about.
I'm going to follow my desires.
Right. Where I might say, as a guy that's, you know, whatever age, at the brink of retirement, if you will, you're looking at that a whole different way. No,
yep.
I got to keep doing this. I got to. So anyway.
Yep.
I think the pandemic really changed a lot of people's minds.
Yeah,
just
yeah.
Because, like, even people that I knew from high school or other places in my life, I see them coming out as their true person to be a different sexuality. I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So it's really just their mind changed. And I think the world's mind's changed.
Yeah. Yep.
The seclusion really had an effect on that because you didn't have people coming in and telling you how to be.
Right, there was, yeah, the traditional approach was kind of lost.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, very good. Okay, so we got to move. Let's look at some weaknesses of the modern approach then. A couple problems with it. Number one, it's self-contradictory. Stephen Stosny is an atheist writer for, he writes on like Psychology Today and stuff. But he said this, the drive to be autonomous, able to decide your own thoughts, feelings, and behavior, in other words, the modern approach, must compete with an equally strong drive to connect to others. We want to be free and independent without feeling controlled. At the same time, we want to rely on significant others and have them rely on us for support and cooperation. So what Stephen Stosny is saying here is that we're kind of like a walking civil war where, like, we want to have the autonomy to be able to decide what I want to do, and but at the same time, it, in order to connect with other people, does that mean that there's got to be some kind of acquiescence to their expectations? Like, imagine you got like two people that are going to get married, and both of them have a strict modern approach to identity. I'm going to be whatever I want to be. How's that marriage going to work? It's going to be pretty stinky. Like, there's got to be some acquiescing to each other and adjusting to each other. So just don't marry a self-centered person. That's a major problem with this idea. So when people say, be true to yourself, be true to yourself, you're like, well, I don't even understand myself. Because it seems like my desires are changing every couple of months. You know, the military, if you've shown the military that you're interested in joining and you decline initially, they call you back every 3 months because they figure every 3 months there's been some major or minor thing that's happened in your life that affects the way that you frame and look at everything. And so, like, how many of you have had competing desires at times? Like, I want to be really great in my career, but I also want to have kids and a family, and, like, it's going to be hard to have those things coexist. Were you going to say something?
Yeah, no. I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, when I was first starting out, I was like, I want to be an artist, but hey.
You gotta
get
money.
I gotta put food on the table, so I can get a job.
Right. So when people say, be true to yourself, be true to yourself, how many of you guys, like, really understand yourself really well to even know how to do that? I don't. So there's internal self-contradictions that are involved with that. So that's the first criticism of that. Anything you guys want to add to that one?
I'm not sure if this is mentioned in the second portion of it, but I also think it's self-contradictory in that being true to yourself, you still want people, you want people to recognize what you consider your true self. So
yes,
it's any attempt of saying I don't care what other people think is secretly a cry of no, please validate my choices.
Yes, this is going to be
because if you don't validate it, then I will be stuck in self-loathing.
Yes, this is going to be the third criticism of it. It's ultimately an illusion. So notice the second weakness of the modern approach. Ernest Becker, I think it was in 1974, wrote a book called The Denial of Death. And the book is about when you accept a secular worldview, how do we deal with death and our deep metaphysical needs? And he was an atheist that wrote this. It won the Pulitzer Prize. But look what he said in part of this book here. What is it that we want when we elevate the love partner to the position of God? We want redemption, nothing less. We want to be rid of our faults, of our feeling of nothingness. We want to be justified to know that our creation has not been in vain. We turn to the love partner for the experience of the heroic, for perfect validation. We expect them to make us good through love. Needless to say, human partners can't do this. The lover does not dispense cosmic heroism. He cannot give absolution in his name. The reason is that, as a finite being, he too is doomed. And we read that doom in his own fallibilities, which you would see every day when you're with the person, in his very deterioration. Redemption can only come from the outside, from outside the individual, from beyond. So here, he's saying that, and this goes back to some of what Ian was actually just saying, that if you want to be true to yourself and you demand that everybody kind of accept it, what if a million people were okay with you, but one person criticized you? What's going to weigh more heavily?
That one person.
The one person. So, like, when Ernest Becker is saying, like, when you get rid of the idea of God, and he's writing as an atheist, by the way. He said, okay, when you get rid of the idea of God, one of the mistakes people make is they put a love partner to the position of God in their life, expecting that person to give them absolution, this sense of understanding, being made good, like having a good view of yourself and all that kind of stuff. Why can't other people do that?
Because they can't do it themselves.
Yeah, they have their own deterioration to worry about. Like, you can't elevate somebody to the position of God because they're not God, and they can't, like, no matter how much praise they would give you for expressing yourself or whatever. It reminds me of the book of Esther, where you have Haman. Remember, everybody bows down to him except one guy, Mordecai. And when he goes home to his wife, and she's like, how was your day? I don't know what her voice was like. But, like, how was your day? He's like, he can't just say, oh, it was a really good day. Most people really respected me. Like, what's the first thing he has to talk about?
Mordecai.
And so, do you guys see the point here? That you have these pride parades and you need everybody to accept who you really are. One criticism is going to drive you to despair because you need the voice of the crowds praising your decisions for you to feel good about yourself. Okay, so it's very fragile in that way. Anything else you guys want to say about that one? All right, look at the last criticism then. And some of these kind of all come together in a lot of ways, but it's ultimately an illusion. What we live in right now is kind of like a repackaging of the traditional approach. We are built to be people in community, and so therefore it's really hard to escape the idea that we would ever need validation from outside of ourselves. Can you imagine an artist, he's starting to do painting and all this kind of stuff or whatever. So let's say that he starts to bring his paintings to, like, all these art shows, and every single person that looks at it goes, that's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. I don't know what you're trying to do. And then, could you imagine somebody doing this for 5 years, and every time he hears it, he goes, well, I'm just being true to myself. I don't care what anybody else thinks. Do you think they're going to keep it up? No. So you ultimately need praise from other people, so you're going to resort back to the traditional approach. So even think about this. Be true to yourself. That's a cultural demand. Are you being true to yourself, man? You better be. You see, like, so that is kind of like, what are people expecting? They're saying, be true to myself. I think I might be this gender. Oh, and then I get praise. What about this? Our society today, would they be really happy with Christians being true to themselves? I think this is wrong. I think this is right. I think this is what God expects in marriage. All that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Well, I think it's just, like you said, sort of ironic that, you know, we live in this culture that is, like, accept and, you know, point out every individualistic ideology. You know, let's just praise every individual for their, you know, intricacies and their small differences. But yet, you know, when it really gets down to brass tacks, if you are this, 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 and this, you know, as an individual, sorry, like, you don't meet our demands.
Right. Which means that, like, our culture does not really believe be true to yourself.
It's a one-way street.
Yeah, you be true to yourself in these ways that we kind of want to push you down. Here's another example of how this would be an illusion. Is there more pressure for women today to have, like, super successful careers? So, whenever we lived in Atlanta, there was a playground that got built like right by our house. Our house was one of the houses, the closest houses to the playground. So whenever I'd come home from work, I would take the kids out to the playground, and Samantha would work out or whatever. And there would be other moms that would like take their kids to the playground. And so we'd start talking, and they'd be like, oh, what do you do for work? What do you do for work? What does your wife do for work? And I'd say, well, she stays at home with the kids, and she homeschools and stuff. And, like, Samantha's had some pushback for wanting to be a stay-at-home wife, societally. Like, you're not really accomplishing anything with your life. Like, what's the point of this? Like, you're just... Don't you want to go out and actually, like, do something with your life? You're just, like, here with the kids, like, raising them and all that kind of... That doesn't matter. I'm not saying it's wrong for a mom to work or anything like that. But I'm saying that for Samantha to be true to herself, is everybody in society just okay with that? Or do they look at it as, like, she's still submitting to the patriarchy, even if she doesn't realize it?
Number two.
Yeah. That's how it's looked at. By the way, I will say, just as a side point... I think our society today is more oppressive towards women than even the 1950s. So, like, in the 1950s, what was expected of a woman?
Stay at home and raise your kids.
Yeah, stay at home and raise your kids. What's expected of a woman today is that you're really hot, you can cook really good, you're super smart and educated, and you make a bunch of money, and you still, like, take care of the kids really well. Like, what's more oppressive? I'm not trying to defend either culture, by the way, but I would think our culture today is more oppressive towards women than it was 70 years ago in our society. Do you guys agree with that or disagree?
Certainly more overwhelming.
Yeah, yeah, so yeah, overwhelming is maybe a better word for that. But the 40s and 50s was for sure more traditional. Like, you have to people expect certain things.
And the current expectations you described just now, there's no way.
Yeah, no, yeah, nobody.
There is no human way possible for all of that to happen.
Nope. Or here's another question. Is there more pressure for men to not lead? What if I want to be true to myself and I feel like I'm a natural good leader and I'm married? Like, would people look at that as me being sexist and what all those kinds of words are? So I can't be true to myself with regards to my natural ability to lead, you know, whatever. So it's all just an illusion. I have this question here. Do you guys see any other weaknesses to the modern approach?
Well, I think the bottom two are definitely more towards modern feminism.
Yes. Yes.
And the pressure for women to be, oh, you're not a feminist.
Right.
Like, what do you mean?
Yeah, so actually, whenever I get together with Sewell Hall, you guys all know who Sewell is, right? So whenever I would just get together with him every week, and I'd be like, just talk to me and tell me a bunch of stuff. And he said that he thinks that the next thing that's going to really divide churches of Christ in the next 10 or 15 years is not going to be racial issues, but it's going to be women's roles in the church. That's going to be the thing that is going to get pushed more and more and will start to divide churches. So you see the whole idea that happens all throughout the Bible, that sometimes God's people take ideas from the world and then they bring him into the church, and then it starts to corrupt what God wanted. All right, any other comments or questions on any of this before we get to the biblical approach?
My mom works for a preschool that's sponsored by the Lutheran Church, and the Lutheran Church had a massive schism a few years back when they started making women evangelists and elders of the church and whatever the different groups of leaders that they have at the Lutheran Church are, but there was a huge break-off of Lutherans that were just like, this is where we draw the line.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if we're already seeing it in some of these, you know, what we would consider, you know, different
denominations
of Christianity, and, you know,
yeah,
we're not far off.
There's for sure going to be Churches of Christ that we would even right now consider conservative ones in the next 20 years that will be accepting homosexuality and women's roles in the church that the Bible wouldn't allow. I think for sure that's going to be happening with churches right now that we would consider conservative. Yeah.
Another big problem that you see is those last two questions that you have up there. Is there more pressure for women to have careers? And then also, is there more pressure for men to not lead? Well, we're in a state today where that's not even able to be asked because there's not a clear definition of
a man or a woman.
Of man or woman.
Right.
People.
Right.
How can you clearly be a role if you've devolved to where you don't have a role?
Right.
And so that's another problem that you see in the modern feminist movement is if you want to empower women, but you can't define women, how is that empowering women?
Right.
And so, exactly. So, like, there's the idea of wanting to be always true to yourself. With that comes that you can't define even basic societal categories to be able to succeed within society.
Right.
And I think at the very basis, male and female is pretty, like, cornerstone to understanding the roles of people.
Right.
And once that goes, and it's been shuffled to where it is, you can't, it's hard to be true to yourself and want to be a traditional woman when you can't define what a traditional or even what a woman is.
Right. You see why there's so much confusion. Like, this idea of being true to yourself, it just leads into all kinds of internal conflict and societal conflict because there's debates about what is a man or a woman or whatever. Ben?
It kind of seems like a conversation, or like this whole identity crisis that everyone is having, kind of seems like the whole of our society has built in this like pull the plug on our awkward conversations movement. You know, like if you start to ask these questions about
right.
gender roles or gender in general, you know, and
then you're assumed to be a sexist. Or
yes, that you go ahead and say, well, pull the plug on that one, but you already have gone too far.
Right.
But if you keep going with that and just keep saying, you be you, and like everyone can be happy in that, then it ultimately like becomes something that everyone enjoys, you know, but they're not.
Right.
Even in that, and to that extent, you know, there are some people who are accepted in that way, and they're taking it too far on their own, and their peers are identifying that, well, that's too much. You can't do that. Or, you know, the idea that gender is a social construct comes from where? Like, society exists in and of itself. All humans, they create society. So trying to shrug that off and to be yourself and to be whoever you want, society starts to break down, and nobody, to what they were saying, nobody has a role.
Right.
Nobody can play a part in any of it.
Good. I do. So I had a friend in high school who became transgender. He was married, he had a few kids, and he transitioned from being a man to a woman and got so depressed and suicidal, even though he was only being showered with praise. Like, I talked to him on the phone not too long ago for like an hour, and he transitioned back, and his wife took him back. But he just talked about like how everybody was saying, be true to yourself, be true to yourself, be true to yourself. And he's like, okay, I'm trying, and like, I want to kill myself. Because there's something about this that's not right. And he was told, block out anybody that disagrees with you. He said the environment was cult-like. Like, don't let anybody who would ever disagree with you have a voice in your life. And so he shut out all those phone numbers, defriended all those people on Facebook. He was only met with praise. And there was still something within him that had conflictions. So
I think also, moving to a different track, I think a reason that the modern approach can get overloaded, I'll use that term, is because of a overloaded traditional approach. So you go to the silver. Let me go back to that silversmith idea. So you want to be an artist, but you're probably going to be a silversmith because that's what culture designed. So you say to yourself, okay, I can still express my artistic desires through silversmithing. But then if that gets, it's a sense of you want to explore all the roads that are available because you don't want to go down one road and then realize there was more. So I guess to put it in a, well, no, that's not going to be the other one. In a sense, it's a lot of times sort of these haywire modern approach ideals of be true to yourself is because, you know, there was a severe backlash, and I'm not saying whether the backlash is right or not, but a severe backlash in, you know, they couldn't be true to themselves in the sense of, like, it was hard. Like, I knew, so when I worked at Walmart, you know, you meet everybody at Walmart, basically. And there's this one person that I was on good terms with for a while, and he was gay, but I got a chance to actually know him and found he actually came from a pretty bad family.
Yep.
And part of that, no, actually, I think it was an abusive dad.
Okay.
And part of that whole identification was sort of because...
Rebellion.
Not just rebellion, but I believe he was beaten for it because he wasn't sure. And instead of, like, you know, being a correct father and, you know, sitting down and talking through that, he was met with... So he felt like it was his only choice at that point.
Sure. And if you're not getting affection from dad, you need male affection, and then you go through puberty and it becomes eroticized. Yeah.
It was interesting when you were talking about your friend from high school, how it's... The modern approach, you're trying to use your emotion to create your identity, but then you're also told to kind of push it away from your identity and, like, stuff it down.
Right. There's so many confusing things about it. And I think a discussion like this helps us put some words to, like, some of the confusion in our society. But, like, let's then work towards the biblical approach. So, probably the most concise passage in the Bible that I'm aware of that deals with the biblical approach to identity is 1 Corinthians 4, verses 3 and 4. In the context, first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, anybody know what the debated issue is? Why is the church having fights in the first four chapters? I follow Paul, I follow... Like, that's not just in chapter 1, that's what the first four chapters are about. So, Paul is explaining to the Corinthians, you guys are fighting over your favorite creatures... This is how you should view me, and this is how I view me. And so that's where he talks about, like, I labored, he, Apollos watered, whatever the thing is. Like, all of that is about, like, you guys need to understand how preachers should think about themselves and how you guys should think. So it's all about identity, really, the first four chapters. And so he says here, but with me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by any human court. In fact, I do not even judge myself, for I'm not aware of anything against myself, but I'm not thereby acquitted. It is the Lord who judges me. So I want you to see how he rejects, in a sense, both the modern and the traditional approach. He rejects the modern approach by saying, I really don't care what you guys think about me. It's a small thing that I'm judged by you guys or any human court. And you might expect him to go, I don't care what you guys think about me. I care what I think about me. But he doesn't say that either. In fact, he says, I don't care what I think about myself. He says, I'm not aware of anything against. I don't even judge myself. I don't assess myself. I'm not aware of anything against myself. In other words, my conscience, there's nothing weighing on my conscience. But even though my conscience feels clean right now, that doesn't mean that I'm acquitted, because my conscience could be wrong. The Lord is who judges me. So I don't care what you guys think about me. I don't care what I think about me. What I care about is what? What God thinks about me. So is there a sense in which the traditional approach to identity building is part of our psychology? We do need some kind of praise or affirmation from the outside, and we should get encouragement from brethren and all that sort of thing, but that can end up becoming like a drug hit, where, like, we got some praise, but we need more, and whatever. Ultimately, our praise from the outside needs to come from somebody who's greater than a human being. And so, I ask this question here, what are some of the titles that God has given us? What does God think about a Christian? Yeah, you've been given wisdom.
Was it say saint, friend, servant, disciple?
Yeah, and I like the first three chapters of Ephesians. One of the things that I like to do with somebody shortly after they become a Christian is scan through the first three chapters of Ephesians. I preached this when I was here for the summit thing or whatever it was. But there's like 12 titles that are given to Christians in the first three chapters of Ephesians. You're saint, you're chosen, you're adopted, you're redeemed, you're forgiven, you're loved, you're alive, you're saved, you're God's workmanship, you're a holy temple, you're reconciled, you're strengthened. I have those words all highlighted in my Bible. And that's one of the things that I like to show somebody shortly after they become a Christian, that you meditate on these things. So the next time somebody criticizes you and it's really like driving you mad. Like, think about what God thinks about you. Take the criticism and see if you can learn something from it. But don't let it crush you, because this is what God thinks about you.
How about royal priesthood?
Yeah, royal priesthood. There's so many great pictures of what God is. So we do need affirmation from the outside. Man is fallible, and we know that. We see them deteriorating, like Ernest Becker said. So there's something that's still not quite there that's going to get us all the way by getting human praise. So we need it from the outside, and we need it from God, and this is what God thinks about you.